my age that fly the type of airplane I fly. I'm known as a dinosaur in my industry, and the youngsters usually don't mention that in front of me, but nonetheless, why, you can number perhaps the number of pilots that fly very agile light attack jet fighters, or any of the category of jet fighters, on the number on the fingers of both hands today, but at my age. But it's a thrill to do that. I fly a very agile light attack jet fighter in about five specialized missions that we've learned a lot about since Vietnam. And I fly against Red Flag and Top Gun regularly. We have to in order to continually evaluate ever-changing weapon systems and the maneuvers that go along with them. And it's fun to go out there and tangle with these youngsters of 25 and 35 years old, and it does great things for my ego to have their unit commanders say, don't you go out there and fool with that old man unless you want to get embarrassed. But at any rate, that's a little bit of what I do, and as I said, to explain this phenomenon that's standing up here. Now, I came here this morning to tell you a little bit of my story, and although I'm sure that some of you are aware of some of the things that I may say, perhaps there are some of you here that aren't, and I hope that it'll be beneficial to you anyway. But as you might imagine from all of that, aviation has occupied a major share of my life. In fact, aviation began for me at a very early age. You can believe this or not, but I knew what I wanted to do at the age of five. It was during the Depression years, and my parents were like a lot of people. They didn't have much money back then. My dad was able to afford a half-finished two-room house during that time, and about the time I was five, my mother had an occasion to be away for a couple of weeks, and my dad was left with me, five-year-old toddler, and a whole lot of things that he had to keep doing. And my dad was a very creative individual. He was able to do a multiplicity of things and look after me at the same time, and he did well until about the middle of this two-week period when he made a mistake. He decided to finish roofing the house. Now, being a creative individual, the method he used to look after me at the same time was he took me up on the roof with him and nailed the seat of my pants to the roof so that I wouldn't fall off. And I'll tell you, fellas, you can tell your wives that tenpenny nails are a very effective babysitter. His idea was that the nail was to look after me, and I was to have a practical education instilled in my young mind by watching him shingle this roof. But what the poor man didn't know was he'd bought this house right under the final approach to the local airport, and I spent the entire afternoon watching airplanes go overhead, and thus began my love affair with the airplane. I can still see those pictures, by the way. So strong were they impressed in my young mind. And I did like every other kid. I built model airplanes. I read everything I could get my hands on, and every now and then, why, I'd sneak away and go to the local airport, hang over the fence, and watch the real thing take off and land, until I got into my teens, and I began to make noises about learning how to fly. And boy, that's when things came to a screeching halt. I suddenly discovered that both of my parents were terrified of aviation. They'd been putting little roadblocks in my way all along, and I'd not recognized that. And so we had some outright arguments over this, because I wasn't about to give up. And finally, a compromise was arrived at, and I was allowed to work after school at the local airport as a line boy, sort of an all-purpose grease monkey. And in fact, so important was this compromise that my dad took me the first day I went to work. And we stopped at the entrance to the airport, and he pointed to a sign there beside the road. And he said, now you understand, your mother and I have agreed to this with the specific understanding that you do not avail yourself of what's written on that sign. Sign said flying lessons, so many dollars an hour. And I was learning to be legalistic and devious even at that early age, so I agreed. And I said, yes, sir, I agree not to spend any money on flying lessons. And I didn't. I just took them in compensation on Saturday mornings, and that way, you see, no money changed hands, and I thought I was being honest in doing that. And in those days, you could learn to fly and solo and get your license at an early age without a lot of regulation and without your parents' consent. And I did all that. It took me about a year and a half, and they didn't know. And the only mistake I made was that the day I got my private license, I decided to celebrate by buzzing the house. And somehow or another, my mother knew who that was. And now, you've heard of teenagers being grounded? I'm a living example of a teenager literally grounded for 6 months. And the family arguments began all over again, and the family strife and so forth. And I guess with the wisdom that only parents can have, they realized this thing was not going to go away, so they allowed me to continue my first love. Now, this was right after World War II had ended, and I knew that I wanted aviation to be my life's work, but I didn't know how to get into professional aviation. And there were a couple of things that happened about that time that sort of steered me, you might say, and one of them was a Hollywood movie. Now, I'm not terribly thrilled about all that Hollywood produces, especially these days, but this one greatly caught my attention. It was entitled Test Pilot. It starred Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, and Myrna Loy, and it had Clark Gable flight testing the very latest airplanes of the day across the screen, and he and Spencer Tracy were involved in the latest technologies, And it was just a thrilling portrayal of a new area of aviation that piqued my interest. I went to see that movie, I guess, 100 times. I drove a stake in the ground for me to focus on, but it still didn't tell me how to get there. And another thing occurred about that time that was a little more practical. They had just started the National Aerobatic Championships again after the war. And in down in Florida, every year they held these competitions, and the best pilots in the country went. And whoever won that thing was really Mr. Somebody in aviation. And I figured if I could begin studying aerobatics and get good enough someday to be able to compete, and then by some miracle one day win it, why, that would be a major stepping stone into the area of aviation I was interested in. And so I began studying aerobatics. And about 3 months after I'd started, I'd had a lot of help along the way. I was out in the practice area at about 3,000 feet one day doing 8-point slow rolls and other maneuvers, and my dad happened to be driving along on the ground underneath that area and looked up and saw this airplane, and somehow or another he knew who that was, and we had the grounding thing all over again and the family arguments and so forth. Now, I hadn't been terribly swift on my feet in those days, but I did notice that right after my flying became public, as it were, in the family, why, a change was occurring in our family routine. Every summer, during the 3-month school vacation, why, we were being uprooted now from California and brought back here to Oklahoma. Now, my grandparents were pioneers in this state. They went in with the land rush of 1889 into the Oklahoma territories here and homesteaded large sections of land right around Oklahoma City. In fact, my grandfather established the first commercial dairy in this state. It wasn't any tremendous empire, but it was a marvelous place for a city kid like me to be able to ride horses, you know, and swim in the streams and sleep out under the stars with your saddle as a pillow. And when I get over my peak of having to leave aviation for 3 months, because that was the real reason for these trips, why, I enjoyed those summers. I got to meet all the family clan in the doing of that. All the aunts and the uncles and the cousins and so forth. And early on, I had identified a weird aunt. Now, I'm sure everybody's had a strange relative or two in your family tree, and I sure did. This woman did strange things. At least they were strange to me. She prayed out loud before she ate her meals at dinner time. Read her Bible right on front of everybody. Went to church 2-3 times a week. Now, that made her frightening to me because those things were missing in my growing up period. My mother and father were fine moral people, but apparently there just wasn't time for that in our family. We went to church maybe once a year, you know, to be kept from being called heathens in the neighborhood, but that made this woman terrifying to me. I was always afraid someday she was going to corner me and pour religion down my throat or something terrible like that, and so I stayed as far away from her as I could until I reached my my last trip. I had just graduated from high school, and I went back one last time, and she succeeded in cornering me, and I thought, oh boy, here it comes. And she sat me down and began to talk to me not at all about what I was afraid she was going to. She had a quality known as wisdom. I didn't know much about that word in those days. And she began on this wise. She said, you know, if you're ever going to amount to anything in this profession you've chosen, you ought to go on to college. You ought to get a higher education, get an aeronautical engineering degree. Well, I was ready to reject that out of hand because I already had my number one educational objective, and that was to go to Florida and enter the aerobatic competitions. But before I could get that out of my mouth, she dangled a carrot in front of me I couldn't resist. She said, if you'll go, I'll pay for the first year's room, board, and tuition. So I thought, well, what can I lose? I'll try it for a week or two, and if I don't like it, I can always leave. Should have known better when she already had the college picked out. But nonetheless, that September, I found myself standing on the campus of a small college not far from here, up in Arkansas, in the Ozarks. And after I'd registered and went and checked into the men's dormitory and got settled in my room, I decided to go out and explore the campus. And the first thing that happened is I was walking along the sidewalks, I ran into a bunch of nuts carrying Bibles under their arms, and I knew instantly that my aunt had betrayed me and that I had fallen into a hotbed of religion. And I turned around, marched back to my room, determined to pack and leave the next day. But a strange thing occurred that evening. Little by little, I ran into 14 other guys of the same ilk I was. They, too, had been conned into coming to this nut house just like I had. And they, too, had been out walking the sidewalks and seen the same sights I had, more or less were coming to the same conclusions. And you know how birds of a feather sort of flock together. We'd all found each other, I believe, by about 2 o'clock in the morning. And we decided that it'd be much more fun, instead of leaving, to stick around and form a club and see what kind of devilment we could create for these nuts and for the faculty of this institution. And that's when my college education really began. I began to learn things you wouldn't believe. Most of them weren't on the school curriculum, but nonetheless, and I was a fast learner, by the way. I identified my major right off the bat. I majored in mistakes that organizations and people make. And the first person that I'd learned about that had made a mistake was my aunt. She had put the entire year's worth of room, board, and tuition in cash in my hands. She She was a wise woman, but not too smart. And money does strange things to people, you know, and it sure did to me. It opened up whole new vistas of opportunity for me. In fact, I began a research program with my newfound wealth, several of them, in fact. And in my research, I discovered a major organization about that time that was making some mistakes. It's called the United States Government. I'm not so sure they stopped doing that, but at any rate, you could buy a pretty advanced Army training aircraft, war surplus, for about half the amount my aunt had given me. So I made a snap decision and decided that I'd pay for the first half of the year's room, board, and tuition. We'd let the second half worry about itself when it got here, and I bought one of these things. Now, precipitating that was, and you'll have to sort of follow me because these are all kind of connected together, was another discovery I'd made that the college had made a mistake. They owned an airport, which happened to be right down on the bottom of the hill the campus was located on, and they didn't know what to do with it, but I did. And so I brought the airplane there, and now I had the basis for a dual educational pursuit, you see. The continuation of my study of aerobatics and the pursuit of a college education. Now, I should pause to tell you that the aerobatic study did have some method to it. In those days, the competitions were relatively simple. Those competitions go on to this day, by the way. They've become greatly expanded and much more complex. They've become an Olympic event now, in fact, an international event. A great deal of good for aviation in general has come out of them. But in those days, as I said, they were relatively simple. Each pilot could select the series of maneuvers that he wanted to perform in competition, form them into what's known as a routine, and the only real limitations were that they all had to be done within a very short period of time. Time was the same for every pilot, and within a very concise airspace. And I'd been working hard on my maneuvers. These maneuvers are very difficult to learn. They're even more difficult to perfect a competition level. Now, there were two low-altitude maneuvers that were allowed in competition in those days. They don't do that anymore, but I had selected the two that I was going to use. The first one was going to be my entry maneuver, the very first maneuver performed upon leaving the field where the competition was held. First impressions are always important, and they certainly were here. And it was a low-altitude, very violent maneuver, and it went like this. After doing the run-up at the end of the runway, I turn around and line up with the runway, take off and climb to about 15 or 20 feet, and at this very low altitude, I'd retract the landing gear and the flaps, accelerate out to the maximum speed that I could reach at this altitude, pull up vertically and do a vertical snap roll, and on a very precise heading, push over and sort of disappear off into the sunset, as it were. Now, it had two purposes in those days. One was I got to practice it every time I left the airport. The second was it was kind of my signature maneuver. Groups of students and faculty would gather on the college hill to watch this amazing display. Students loved it. Faculty had other thoughts about it, but nonetheless, there wasn't any doubt as to who was leaving the airport when I do this. Now, the other maneuver, I developed out away from the airport, and I discovered out there that the Ozarks are rolling hills and are forested. And after I'd finished my air work, why, we'd do some recreational flying. And I found out that you can fly through the ravines below hilltop level and treetop level for an extended period of time. Sooner or later, you come to a dead end. And it was kind of fun doing that. In fact, I invented the airborne version of the game of chicken in doing this. When you fly through these ravines and you come to a dead end, whoever grabs the stick first falls above the treetop level, and an airplane has two sets of controls in it, why, that guy was the chicken. It was during the game of chicken that I made a discovery that I'll pass on to you. It was actually an increase in my college education. I wasn't looking for it, but it happened. And I will give this to you free of charge. I guarantee it'll increase your education as well. I'm sure that many of you here are familiar with ranching or animal husbandry or farming, but did you know that a cow can outrun a horse? Now, I made that discovery quite by accident one day. And coming out of a ravine instead of a dead end, there was a large pasture in front of me populated with a variety of horses and cows. And I want to tell you, a properly motivated cow will outrun a horse any day of the week. There's just something about a Pratt & Whitney R1340 aircraft engine coming at a cow at 150 miles an hour does strange things to their psyche. Now, we were beginning to enjoy college, by the way, about this time. We had revised our opinion considerably. We were staying just ahead of the campus cops. That's what we called the faculty. And not doing anything too outrageous, at least within sight, and keeping our grades above red line, until one day, things came to a screeching halt again for me. I ran head-on into an individual that had all the characteristics of my aunt. And the way that happened was that somebody discovered I was not taking a required course in this college. I thought I'd gotten away with it, but they found me out. And guess what the course was? Bible. And I had to start taking this course. And the individual I'm referring to was the professor of Bible. And I always sat way back in the back of his class. And the instant class is over, why, I'd escape out the back door. So one day, I was escaping out the back door, and there he stood. And how in the world he ever got from the front of the class to the back that quick, I'll never know. But he collared me, and I thought, sure, he discovered some major infraction that I was guilty of, but not at all. He invited me to his home for dinner. Said he and his wife would like me to come to their home one evening, and I wasn't fast enough on my feet to think of a good excuse, so I agreed, and the time came, and I went, and they were a cordial couple, and dinner was marvelous, and afterwards, he invited me into his study to talk. Now, I knew pretty much what was coming, and I was prepared to turn him off. But there were two things that prevented that, and they might be worth something to some of you. After we were settled in his study, why, I suddenly became aware, for the first time in my life, that I was confronted with someone outside of my immediate family that cared about me. And the second thing that struck me, because I secretly admired this man, he was a very knowledgeable and a very capable man, was that he had taken the time out of his busy schedule to talk to me. And I'd never had anybody do that before. And so I decided to listen. And even that was a surprise. I wasn't prepared for it. He said, you know, you're in an institution of higher learning. And sooner or later, you're going to be confronted with a course that will teach about the origins of the universe, the origins of the earth, the origins of mankind. And he said, many years ago, I gave a great deal of study to these subjects, and I'm going to give you the benefit of a little bit of what I learned. He said, after studying these subjects extensively, I came to the conclusion that there are only two basic premises at the bottom of them. You can come at them from any direction you want, but you'll always wind up at these two premises. One premise holds that in the beginning, there was a cataclysmic explosion that happened eons ago. And since that time, the heavens and the earth and mankind and all living things have been formed by a process known as evolution. He said, the other position holds that there's an almighty, all-knowing, all-capable God who created the heavens and the earth, and mankind in particular. And he said, after leaving these studies, I went into the study of the sciences that were related. And as I began to study the sciences, little by little, I became aware of the enormity of the power that I was seeing unfolded in front of me, and the genius of design and creativity. And he said, little by little, I came to the conclusion that there had to be somebody behind this. And he said, one of the things that drove me to that conclusion was a single word. He said, I discovered early on that there's only one word that can adequately describe evolution. He said, you can get a PhD in a variety of subjects that have to do with evolution, but you can't escape that one word. That word is the only one in our language that adequately describes evolution. And he said, that word is accident. And he said, I could in no wise reconcile what I had begun to see in my study of the physical sciences with that word. And so I came to believe that indeed there is a God. And he said, he went on and described to me how that God in the beginning had created man in particular. And that man, because of his disobedience, was separated from God. And that God desired a reconciliation. And then he introduced me to someone I had only known in a profane way up to this night, Jesus Christ. And the minute he mentioned that name, I became very uncomfortable. He, being a wise man, described to me what Jesus Christ did 2,000 years ago and how that he had accomplished that which was necessary for man to find his way back to God in a miraculous work, that which was necessary for man to have his sins forgiven or to be able to have his sins forgiven, that which was necessary for man to have an eternal reconciliation with the God of eternity and an eternal home. Well, those were all foreign things to me, and I was very nervous, and he knew it. So he let me off the hook, and we went to the front door, and before I could escape out into the night, he said, there's one more thing. He says, I know you're uncomfortable, and this may make you more so, but my wife and I care about you. We've been praying for you. Perhaps you've never had anyone pray for you before, and as far as I knew, I hadn't. And he said, we're going to continue praying. We're praying that God will bring you to the point of where you'll recognize a very scientific fact, the fact that you're going to leave this life one day, and that you're going to stand before this God, and that you're going to give an account of yourself. But we're praying most of all that before that day arrives, that you'll come to know this Jesus Christ that I've been telling you about and receive the gift that he has to offer. Well, I couldn't wait, and he knew that, and so I escaped back out into the night and went back to staying just ahead of the campus cops and continuing my dual education. And several months later, I should have told you there were three other pilots in this ragtag group of 14. They weren't quite as far along as I was, and one of them began to bug me to check him out in this airplane that I'd been flying, and so I put him in the front seat and flew with him for several hours training him, and he became proficient in the airplane, and the day came to solo him. And we went out to the airport, did our walk-around inspection of the aircraft. I helped him on with his parachute. We got up on the wing, and I watched him strap in, go through the start procedure, and tapped him on the shoulder, and I got down off the wing and watched him taxi away. He got down to the end of the runway, did the run-up and the pre-flight checklist just like I trained him, turned around and lined up with the runway, took off and climbed to about 30 feet, leveled off, retracted the gear and the flaps, accelerated out, pulled up and tried to emulate the maneuver that he'd ridden with me through so many times. And at about 500 feet, he lost control of the airplane and pitched over and dove straight into the ground at about 150 miles an hour. I had never seen death before, and I was confronted with it in a very violent way, and to say that I was a shocked young man is a gross understatement. I'll never forget that day as long as I live. But I wasn't shocked enough that my education didn't move forward in directions that I'd never dreamed that it would. It hit me like a runaway express train that I was responsible. That was another word I didn't know much about in those days. If anybody belonged in that pile of smoking wreckage, it was me and not my friend, and I knew it. Another thing that struck me that might be worth something to some of you as men in particular, it had never dawned on me that somebody might follow me, but I was suddenly very aware that somebody had been following in my footsteps. And for death, I had absolutely no answer whatsoever. I went back to my dormitory room after the events of that day and locked the door, got down on my knees beside my bed and tried to pray. I'd never prayed before in my life. I didn't know how to pray. And the only thing I could do was cry out and say, "Oh God, what's happened to me today is too great for me to bear. I can't handle it." And somehow or another, a formal prayer came to my mind. I'd learned it in the Bible professor's class, and I cried that out. And I said, "Oh God, be merciful to me, a sinner, and save me for Jesus Christ's sake." That night I discovered that indeed there is a God, and that he's a God of his promise, because he answered my prayer. And he performed a miracle for me that night. He literally changed my life, not just for a day or a month or a year, but he changed it forever. And there were a couple of misconceptions that I had about being